You are listening to Kilometer Zero by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hey, this is Kate Wagner for my audio diary for the Cycling Podcast. It is the end of stage five. I'm sitting on the bed of my hotel, which is decorated with a bunch of retro-looking things. I think it's supposed to be cute, an antique shop or something like that. But there's actually, candy taped on the walls, and I'm, not sure if that's... Can you eat it? Or I wouldn't eat it, but it is a little bit tempting. It's like candy in jars and stuff. It's like... Is that for me? No? Okay. So the time trial is really different for us. Yeah, we go to the mix zone, and I got this idea to go to the mix zone at 11:30 and just stand there all day and talk to whoever wanted to come by. And that was a good idea, even though my feet hurt. I didn't really go into the press center today, but I did get to see. It's fascinating, the time trial, because they come in one by one. So you can really see them up close and, get a chance to talk to sort of more guys. The weather was bad, so they didn't stop for long, but I did get some good stuff. Yeah, it was a crazy time trial, as we all know from episode of the Cycling Podcast, but I tell you what, it's funny to me because, I know Roglic pretty well at this point, and I didn't see that coming. I didn't see him coming back like that. And to see him come back like that after the injury is just unbelievable. And of course, we can't forget Matthew Vanderpool staying in yellow. Amazing. Beating off Tadej Pogačar to stay in yellow. Holding him off. Amazing. And then Tadej, he's unreal. He's the real deal. The thing that really struck me about him is he... there's a moment in the time trial where he looks back at the camera and gives this really kind of flirtatious, seductive smile. It's like, aha, he's the boy prince, and he was in resplendent form today. He had to feel bad for Stefan Kung, though, and he came by and answered some questions that Richard had. But he looked pretty crushed. Yeah, so we'll see, but it was a different experience, even though I had to stand out there in the rain. It wasn't so bad. I was fine standing out there in the rain, even though I didn't have an umbrella, because I'm just that determined to do my job. So, yeah, that's my short little audio diary for today on stage five. Hello, this is Kate for the Cycling Podcast. We're hotel report. We're staying at a chateau that is very beautiful, very 19th century classic French chateau. It's huge. The rooms are very splendidly decorated with wallpaper. When I'm not so hungry, I'll probably talk more about it. But for now, it's a pretty splendid. There's a big soaking tub, which I'm going to take advantage of because it was hot as hell today. And it wasn't really a great day for me. I came with one mission, which was to talk to Tadej Pogačar, and that never happened. So that's annoying. But you know what else is annoying? Me. I can be very annoying. And I plan to be as annoying about this as possible. And if it never materializes, then I'm just going to write about how annoying I was being and that it never happened. But yeah, anyways, it was hot and miserable and not really that. It was a lot of driving today. I didn't even have to drive because I can't drive, but Richard was driving a lot today. Kind of one of the staler days at the tour. But I'm looking forward to, and that's the thing, they can't all be bangers. I mean, the stage was great. As far as Cav winning again, getting closer and closer to the Merckx record, which is pretty sweet, honestly. I think he could probably do it if he continues on like this. But for us, it's a little bit different. Yeah, it was kind of a tiring day, and no one stopped in the mix zone after, really. Richard got to talk to Casper Asgreen, Michael Morkow, but none of the people I was looking for showed up. They all just, like, go. If they don't have to talk, like, they won't talk. So it was definitely one of those days. So I didn't get, like, any interviews today, which is, like, really annoying. But, yeah, I think part of my thing is, like, I'm just, like, a little too overeager and asking for a little too much too soon. But you have to ask, you know. That's part of your job. It's like I said, bring me Wilco Kelderman. Except for I didn't ask that today. I didn't ask for him. I probably could have. He's not having a great time these days. But I did hear Ida Schelling talking to TV guys saying that he wasn't going to go in the break tomorrow because he wanted to help out his beleaguered GC men, which is admirable. So we'll see. It's like really interesting race so far. Tomorrow could be interesting. I think it's a day for the breakaway tomorrow. So I might ask to talk to some breakaway guys. Trying to think who. Thomas DeGent, maybe. Any of the Lotto guys at this point. Don't think Roger Kluge will go back out there. But it's nice. It's funny to me that they just built, like, this incredible, like, French chateau in the middle of nowhere. Pretty wild. I'll talk more about the architecture later. I need a beer. All right, that's me signing off. Bye-bye. Hey, this is Kate from the Cycling Podcast. Walking back down from Le Grand Bornay, stage 8. I guess this is I like to capture a little bit of my own reaction here. Yeah, just was watching the Eurosport guys interview Tadej Pogacar, and it's really strange to be close to something so unbelievably powerful. It's frightening. I don't know, it's all I can think about is I can't really breathe, honestly. I don't know how to even say this without sounding like a freak, but have you ever, you know, when you walk into a building, like, say, like, you know, a Gothic cathedral, and that moment of just unbelievable awe, where your heart kind of just lurches in your chest and your stomach sinks, and it's like so sublime and expansive, this thing that you're witnessing, something truly extraordinary, that you're in some kind of presence, like almost a divine presence, though I shouldn't say that, but I already did, I already said it, so yeah, it's like that. Being in the presence of the boy is like that. An unbelievably calm and serene individual. With, just like, you could tell that he has absolute certainty about the world and about his place in it. And nobody has that. Nobody. Except him. You could tell he was so happy to be there in the yellow jersey again. His eyes sparkled. And he was beautiful. Just striking. And you know you're in the presence of something that is going to change everything. And you're there at the moment of transition into a dynasty, into, you know, whatever, the era of Pogacar, but
I stayed around after in the mix zone, even though it was raining, even though I'll never get a chance to talk to him probably ever in my life. But yeah, I just wanted to be there at the moment of triumph, of transition. I wanted to witness history. And I feel changed by it in some way I can't define. Things are different now here. Everyone's depressed. Everyone wants to go home because they think the race is over. But I keep saying no race is over until they ride into Paris. And they're a long way off from that. It's beautiful here in the Alps, where the mist of rain mixes with the conifers and obscures the sky. And as the weather changes, so too does the course of the race. I wouldn't even say it's that boy's race to lose. It's just his task to complete it. But you can't hate him. He's not... I'm so conflicted because it's like, oh, I'm here for 3 weeks and I have to cover this, and it's just, he's going to be a walk in the park for him. But to see him there, to see him standing there like that, honestly, it's one of those things where you witness it in life and it kind of makes you want to cry, though I cry at everything. But I never feel that way in the presence of people. It's always buildings or places like this where the Alps tower above you, but in this case, it was this. I guess this is a private thing for me to share. And everyone's probably going to call me like a fangirl or whatever, though we all know that that's not true. I've never seen anyone own glory like the way he does. He is a prince, but he's not really a prince anymore. Now he's really the boy king in gold. Let us bear witness at the throne. That's from my report from stage 8.
You are listening to Kilometer Zero by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Hey everyone, Sam again. So just back to the bus now, post-race. Wasn't the day for me, wasn't supposed to be. Got through a lot of the race, it started to kick off again on the fifth and sixth lap, and I wasn't able to go with the group. So unfortunately DNF, but I was able to help David and keep him in position towards the back end of the race. And he was a really, really strong fighting performance from David Lozano, a really strong climber. So great to see him up there. It was a really strong and stacked field, fast. It was a selection after selection. So not too disappointed. I mean, I would have liked more, but what I had today is everything I gave, and I was able to help my teammates. So that's as important as anything. So thank you very much for following through the race, and I really appreciate it. So thank you very much.
This is Kate Wagner for the Cycling Podcast. This is my July 6th audio diary entry. I'm sitting in my hotel here in Valence. That's right. Yeah, time has this really annoying way of going by unnoticed. Like, what stage are we on again? 9? I think so. The race might be extraordinary, but for me, every day is kind of similar. In the mornings, I lay in bed in whatever hotel or chateau we're staying in. Though now it's just me alone. I'm no longer with Richard and Francois.
And I think of what it is I have to do, who it is I have to talk to, how I'll spend, you know, my words, plan my day. Some of the writers I like to talk to, some of them I like to talk to so much that they lend me a reason for doing any, if not all, of this. And some of them infuriate me to no end. Some of them are unapproachable, and I fear some of them hate me, though I'm never sure if it's me specifically they hate or my ilk, aka journalists. Anyways, I have a certain amount of work I have to get done on a given day. Sometimes it's a feature in the middle of the week, 2,000 words. Sometimes it's a newsletter for derailer.net. Sometimes it's illustration. Sometimes it's this audio diary, it's the cycling podcast, etc. However, most of the day is spent riding in cars. It's like an hour to the mix zone and then 2 to 3 to the finish. The scenery passes by. It's like accompanied by the race on GCN, or drafts of the cycling podcast, or music sometimes, or idle conversation. Every once in a while, like, someone will, in the car, usually Francois, will make a phone call. He's always on phone calls. They all sound very important. I never make phone calls because I told everyone who's not a part of the race not to call me. I'll call them. I'll miss Richard and Francois, who have been, like, really great company. But not really for so long, because A, I'll see them every day in the mix zone and in the press room, and B, I'll see them on Saturday. I'll be staying with them on Saturday again, so look forward to that. The days on the tour are actually quite long. Like, I get up around 8 and then sort of lumber around like a moron for an hour, daydreaming, thinking about things. Kind of like my time of planning and reflection, like I said earlier. Then I eat breakfast, usually croissants, which I never thought I would get tired of because there's kind of a delicacy in the US, but I'm like starting to get a little bit tired of them. And then it's driving. Well, riding for me, because I don't drive. Like, when I'm home, I ride a bike with panniers, which is not driving. Then it's an hour in the mix zone, shoved in like cattle with your colleagues on the factory farm of 2-minute sound bites. Every day we all watch with envy as the comms directors deliver the yellow jersey wearer to the television men and never us. We never see him, we never ask him questions except for in the after race presser. We never get any time with him whatsoever. He may as well not exist for us, us being the written press. You know, but I find ways to observe him. Tadej Pogačar, and this occupies actually a decent chunk of my time. Especially after the stage, when I'll kind of like linger around the TV pens, just like a parasite, to just have him stand there like 5 feet away from me. And yeah, after the 7th stage, which I think I did an audio diary about this too, I stood there and I watched him be interviewed by Eurosport. And Tadej doesn't like to look into the looming gaze of the camera. So he decided to kind of just, like, stare at me as, like, something to stare at. Like, head on, instead of just, like, yeah, for the full 2 minutes of the interview. And I kind of, like, just stared back at him, because, like, yeah, it doesn't intimidate me. But at the same time, he does, actually. Like, I know in my heart of hearts that he's just a kid who probably reads, like, dumb crap on the internet. Like, the best of them, and oh yeah, likes fast cars and like bad pop music and whatever, but when he's in that jersey, he's very much like a little king, and the whole experience always leaves me rather shaken, you know, like as though I'm in the presence of something far more extraordinary than I am capable of comprehending, much less being. And I guess royalty is like that, I suppose, you know, our boy king. No longer boy prince, certainly boy king now at this point. So yeah, writing for a living is mostly an invisible process. It takes place internally, and honestly, it's not something I think about most of the time, except for when I'm proofreading. Words just like come into the brain and go out through the fingers, like it's as natural as any other biomechanical process. Like, drawing requires technique, but writing is just a conversion rate for the brain. It sucks up the time, and somehow one is able to produce words while the race is blaring in one's ears in like two different languages. I was proofreading until the final 10 kilometers of the stage today, and right after Mark Cavendish further cemented his title as perhaps the greatest sprinter of all time, I went back to my little computer and made my little fingers type out my little words until the press conference, which is more of a formality than anything else. You know, one wonders if the questions produced there are really for the cyclist to answer, or rather than they're a sort of kind of demonstration of knowledge on behalf of the askers. And perhaps this is why I don't ask any questions at the press conferences. Most of the day I spent actually watching the race, just like everyone else does on television. Which, honestly, this is still unusual for me because I'm used to watching the race at like 5 in the morning and having the rest of the day afterward to write about watching the race. However, most of the day at the tour is, like I said, spent driving. And the race is another few hours, or the end of the race is another few hours. And then it's more driving. And then it's dinner. And then the day is over. And one wonders, like, where did it go? It was spent traversing from one point to another, not that much different from the cyclists themselves. Like, everyone wants to know what it's like to be on the tour as a writer. And yeah, it's nice. It's a lot of work, but still, it's not so bad for me because I'm writing for print and my deadlines are not immediate. My pieces are mostly reflective and I can take time to write them. Whereas, like, some guys just have to get quotes literally every single day. And those quotes are online by the time most of us get to the press room somehow. I don't know how they do that. The press room always seems to be in a sports complex, often with a rock climbing wall, which makes me wish I brought, you know, rock climbing stuff, but they probably won't let me rock climb for liability reasons. But yeah, on the rest day, there's like actually no rest for the press ever. It's not really a rest day for the writers either, because like they actually go train in the morning and then they do press stuff like basically after 1 p.m. to sometimes like late in the evening, like 7 or 8. So don't ask me what happened on the rest day, because don't ask me really to reflect, because I was on the phone literally from noon until 4. And everything that happened before noon involves plotting what to say on the phone to the, like, 6 different people I talked to. Some of them were, some of them were editors at, like, the magazine that I'm writing for. And my editor at the magazine that I'm writing for. Then I talked to a literary agent. Then I talked to an editor at a different magazine that I don't yet write for. Then I talked to pro cyclists, like I think 4 or 5 different ones. And then the day was over. And then I plugged all this stuff into transcription software. It's like, I know this is a very interesting audio diary spent really delving into. Yeah, this is actually what it's like. I know it sounds really glamorous, but I promise you that we're not all like on the back of motorbikes dictating what happens to the race to some newspaper reporter like it's on this, like this is the 60s or something. No, actually all of us are just crammed in like a massive room that with no air conditioning, churning out words for money. I know this sounds unglamorous and I'm really sorry to ruin the illusion, but it is just, yeah. But I mean, I live for it. It's kind of addictive in its own way. Yeah, I guess this brings me to another thing everyone, I guess, wants to know, which is what it's like to talk to pro cyclists all the time. And the answer to that is, it depends. Some of them are fantastic, wonderful people I thoroughly enjoy conversing with. In fact, I often find myself wishing I could do so out of the formal setting of an interview. And I think perhaps like the best example of this is Matej Mohoric, who on the rest day spoke to me about everything from traffic calming devices to the fires in the Gulf of Mexico, to winning the Junior World Championships, to what he was reading. And he bemoaned finishing the 3 books he'd brought in the first week to read. He's already done with them. And I don't know if he or his comms guy is listening to this, but if you are, I've got an extra book in English I could lend him if he's interested. Some of the guys, however, are difficult. And honestly, mostly it's because they're exhausted. Wouldn't you be if you were them? That's a good question. Everyone on UAE Team Emirates is like tight-lipped and banged up and not really in the mood to deal with any more stress besides that which comes with defending the yellow jersey in the rather scrappy way they have to go about doing so. They're not usually in a good... First of all, they're hard to get to because it's the yellow jersey's team. And second of all, they're really stressed out. You kind of feel bad for talking to them. I feel bad for talking to Mark Hirschi after the time trial when he was clearly in so much pain. So, Mark, I am so sorry. Please talk to me again at some point when you're not in so much pain. And I'm sorry for asking about the pain when you were in so much pain. Like, what else were you going to say except for, it hurts, you know? Yeah, terrible. That was, like, the worst part of the whole tour for me, to be honest. And, like, some riders, yeah, just, you know, don't have that much to say. After all, like, what can one say about bike racing other than, you know, I hope I'm good at it today. I hope I have the good legs, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I hope I don't crash. But, yeah, I try to give all of them the benefit of the doubt. And besides, the mix zone is less a place to have, like, a real conversation and more a kind of stockyard for getting quotes. Now that I'm on my own again, I have more time to work and can settle back into the mindset of solitude that comes when one's traveling. So I'm sitting here in my like hotel room trying to come up with things to say. It's like an okay hotel room. It's clean and modern, which is all one can ask for. It's like slightly better than a campanile. The mattress is a little stiff. It's definitely not Richard and Francois accommodations, but it will do. It will do. I guess everyone here is expecting me to say something deep and introspective about Roglic leaving. But I obviously had a lot of feelings about this when it happened, though you could tell from my sort of emotional diary from the day. I saw it coming after stage three and really had plenty of time to brace myself for it. I'm mostly heartbroken for him, you know, for his loss, which he's accepted with such grace, as he always does with loss, which is he's probably one of the best losers in cycling history in terms of, like, the graciousness of it. It's like he always does. It's a testament to his resilience and his pretty much impeccable character. But also with Roglic especially, it's easy to pin emotion on him that just isn't there. It's easy for us to infer that he feels a certain way when, in reality, he's, like, kind of got the brain of a champion and has probably, as sad as he is, he's probably already moved on to thinking about the Vuelta at this point. It's really tempting to project our emotions as followers of the sport, whether you're, like, a fan or as a journalist or as someone who writes about the human condition, onto him. But the thing about Roglic is that he really is always looking forward and never back. And to be honest, this makes him sometimes rather annoying to interview. But it also makes his whole outlook on life quite a bit healthier for someone of his particular profession. Still, I'd be lying if I said I won't miss seeing him in the morning, and there will be other times, however, for me to see him, and I'm sure of it. I'm also going to go to the Vuelta. I'm going to, like, use the money I make going to the Tour to go to the Vuelta, because I have a problem. I was actually originally going to go to the Vuelta. The Tour, like I said in my first audio diary, was a real impulse decision. And the reason I wanted to go to the Vuelta is because I have, like, passable Spanish that I could use in, like, a traveling situation. Yeah, that'll be a little bit easier for me because I literally speak no French. And I just kind of, like, bumble around like a small child all the time, being really pathetic about not speaking French. Though most of the time I can kind of get away with it because I'm, like, a little bit cute, and also I'm so very clearly lost that I think people just feel bad for me. Yeah. I don't really want to think about Roglic that much. It's a little too sad. Anyways, tomorrow is Mont Ventoux. Yeah, wow. Wow, huh? Yeah, it's a bald face being perhaps the most iconic climb in cycling. And it is definitely the defining stage of this Tour de France. Who knows, maybe Mazursky wrote the piece Night on Bald Mountain about Mont Ventoux. I don't know if that's true. It's probably about a mountain in Russia. But in my mind, it's about Mont Ventoux. That's all that matters. The opportunity to visit Mont Ventoux feels rather like traveling to see Liberty. And coming from Pamplet, Chicago, the idea of climbing something like that seems decidedly impossible. And yet, they have to do it. And they have to do it twice. That's cycling. Just when you go through a week that can't seem to get any more brutal, the sport finds yet another way to whittle down the weak and test the strong. Hence, going into week two, you know, I'd like to just think that I'm still listed amongst the ranks of the latter. The strong. And so, on this really freaking rainy day, I leave you all with that. On to week two. Adieu.